heart of the city, where the sun refused to shine. People tell me it ain't no use in trying.
Sometimes the best way to tell the truth is through fiction. This morning, as we head into the Memorial Day weekend, we talk with two writers who use fiction to tell some of the hidden stories of American veterans. Aaron Salello's new novel, Learning to Stay, is the story of an Iraq war vet whose return home strains his marriage nearly to the breaking point. It's a story about a side of the war we don't hear much about, the trauma done to families. Doug Bradley's short story collection, Darrow's Vietnam, captures the war and post-war experiences of Vietnam support troops. They may not have served on the front line, but their experiences could be traumatic too, and their stories are mostly still hidden. I'm Anne Strange Champs with Doug Bradley and Aaron Salello, and we're talking about veteran stories and the healing potential of writing. Aaron and Doug, thank you so much for being here. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Aaron, Learning to Stay is about a marriage in crisis. It's the story of a vet who returns from the Iraq war with traumatic brain injuries and PTSD. But the story is really told from the perspective of his wife. How come?
I thought that that was an important story to tell. You know, when we send troops overseas, we embed journalists with them to tell their stories. And a lot of those troops, when they come back, write those battlefield accounts. And what we don't often hear is what happens when they come home. You know, when the troops come home, the journalists go home too. And those stories are then sort of left undiscovered.
You're not a vet yourself. What got you interested in this?
I am not. It was a combination of several different factors. One was when I first moved to Wisconsin over, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, I worked for then-Governor Doyle, who made a point of never missing a military funeral. And I was on the road with him quite a bit and got to go to more of those services than I would have liked. And so it was not something you easily forget, and that was something that really stuck with me. And I've always also been interested in the sort of the gaps in relationships and what really happens in relationships, and the question of what happens when the person that you married is no longer the person you married to was always one that I really wanted to explore, because I think that it's a pretty universal question in a lot of ways. And so when all the coverage started to come about on traumatic brain injury and PTSD from Afghanistan and Iraq, I thought this is a way into that question that I could explore with some real repercussions for families across the country.
Mm-hmm. Doug, you're a veteran yourself. You served in Vietnam.
I did, from November of 1970 to November of 1971.
And you were in Saigon or near Saigon?
I was near Saigon. I was at the largest army base in the world, Long Binh, and it was about 15 miles northeast of Saigon. But I got into Saigon at least once or twice a week because of I was a military journalist, so we put out a newspaper, and we were either putting it together, pasting it up at MACV headquarters, military command headquarters in Saigon, because they had the best equipment, or getting last week's paper back from Stars and Stripes and mailing it.
So it's been a long time since you saw service yourself, but
yes.
You've got a new collection of short stories out, Darrow's Vietnam. Am I saying Darrow's right?
You are saying it right.
And what does it stand for?
Date eligible for return from overseas. And the way the tours of duty went, Marines served 13 months. Army guys like me served 12. So everybody knew their Darrow's dates. So when you got to Vietnam, you started to count down from 365, because that was the day you were going to go home if you made it. And sadly, the dedication of my book is to all those men and women who did not live to see their Darrow's date. But it was sacred, and that's what kept everybody going. With that, we started in with, we got to get out of this place. And that was sort of what we kept thinking. Let me get out of here and get back home safe.
So why write your short stories now, and what aspect of the war was it you wanted to write about?
And the more I thought about it, being a journalist, I was writing all the time, and I was observing. But realize, of course, I'm in the Army. Talk about embedded. I'm not only embedded, I'm censored. I say what needs to be said that the Army once said. I'm showing the bright side of the endeavor, and there weren't a lot of those.
So you're not only censored, your job is to do the censoring.
Exactly.
Your job is to not tell the truth.
That's right. And so that that was both good and bad. I mean, I was obviously going through this internal struggle with myself, but also I was keeping notes in a journal and trying to sort all this out. And over the course of time, I always thought that writing was a wonderful way, and Aaron and I both talk about this because we teach writing and we work with other writers, especially veterans, is that this is a way to maybe understand or try to figure out the situation that you were in. It can be a breakthrough. But I also thought that, you know, there were, as horrific as combat is, and it is the worst thing we ask our men and women to do, and that is to take another life or have their lives taken. There were five times as many of us in the rear, writing their stories, making their meals, giving them orders, doing the other kinds of support.
Five times as many.
Five times as many.
So there are far more Vietnam veterans in this country who were support troops serving behind the front lines than those who were in combat.
That's right.
I didn't realize that.
And that's the side of the story we never hear, because we even felt less than our own comrades. This is the whole thing about levels of sort of guilt with Vietnam that's even difficult for Vietnam vets, those of us who have survived and then those who were in less precarious situations. But I thought, you know, over time, as I started to look at these were stories I wanted to tell. These were stories I thought people didn't know. It's not always about heroism. It's not about kill or be killed, but it's about decisions. Do I write this? Do I not write this? Do I help the military here, or can I help my brothers there? Race, drugs, the things that are going on in America were happening tenfold in Vietnam.
You said something in your book. You wrote, I wrote it down here. You wrote, some of us wrote the stories, and some of the stories didn't get written, and some of the truth didn't come out. That's the Vietnam I'm still dealing with. It makes me a fraud and a liar. It makes me responsible. Really? That's really, you feel like a liar to have not told
those
stories?
Well, that's, the great thing about 40 years after the experience is it becomes fiction. And so that's a narrator in that story trying to cope with his feelings about what he did or didn't do. That story in particular talks about a riot at Long Bin, we used to call it LBJ, which is not the president, stood for Long Bin Jail, which was one of the most horrible places in the world. And so what he did or didn't do with regard to a race riot that took place there, because about three or four times as many or 10 times as many black soldiers were incarcerated there as were white GIs, because this was 68 in the height of racial tension in America and in the Army. So that's his take on it. Mine is maybe a little more muted. Maybe I would be a little easier on myself now that. But I thought in the context of that story and what that narrator of that tale is dealing with, that's the pain of the war that some vets, even me to an extent, still deal with.
Aaron, I really admire what you have done. I know you must have had to do an enormous amount of research. You must have talked with many vets and many vets' families in order to write the story you did. I have to think that must have had an enormous emotional impact on you.
It really did. Initially, when I took on this project of writing this book, it was just a ton of research and a ton of interviews and that sort of thing. And the farther and farther I got into that research, I thought, who am I to be telling this story? This is not my story. And then I would talk to some of these spouses, and they would say, we can't do this story. One of them said, you know, I'm up to my ears in caregiving for my spouse who has a traumatic brain injury and TBI. And for a lot of them, I think it's maybe too close to their experience. And so I started to realize this is something I not only can do, but I perhaps should do. But it was still scary throughout to really get this right. And honestly, every word I wrote, every sentence I wrote, it was front and center in my mind that there were real people going through these things. There are real people going through these things, and I really needed to get it right. And so it got sent through a ton of beta readers who were related to the military, who had been deployed, who had spouses deployed and come home, excuse me, who had gone through maybe some of the situations that Elise goes through, my narrator in the book. And one of the greatest satisfactions on seeing it published was that the response that I've gotten, and that, you know, that this rings true for them. So
is there a section you could read for us and maybe set it up a bit? Tell us about your characters.
Sure, I'm happy to. So Elise, my narrator, is a young 30-something attorney. She lives in Madison with her husband, Brad, who decided after 9/11 to enlist and was deployed. And she has anticipated his return for quite a while. She's just weathered the, with her best friend Darcy, the what happens when two men in dress green show up at her doorstep. And Elise is lucky enough to have her husband come home. And so this is the first night that Brad has come home, and she finds him standing in her kitchen. And so I'll just read a little short bit of this. Late in the night, I wake and watch Brad sleep. I see him twitch and hear him mumble. I'm exhausted, but the grumbling in my stomach keeps me awake. I haven't eaten since that morning, and then only a packaged blueberry muffin from the firm's vending machine that tasted more like cellophane than blueberry. But the thought that Brad might up and disappear keeps me tethered to the bed. Eventually, my stomach and reasoning went out, and I slip from our room, drying Brad's t-shirt over my head as I go. I make myself a mayonnaise and cheese sandwich, a guilty pleasure I usually deny myself because it's artery-clogging and unhealthy, and because Brad finds it disgusting. But tonight calls for a celebration. I even find one lonely line in Kugelberry Weiss, a remnant of summer, in the back of the refrigerator and crack it open. I stand over the sink, eating and sipping and looking out over our meager backyard, bathed in the light of a low-hanging moon. And that's when I see him. I press my face close to the kitchen window, fighting to see past my reflection and into the yard, where Brad, wearing only jeans, is walking toward the back fence. I can see shadows of scars that crisscross his back and shoulders, looking louder and angrier than Brad ever has been. Although it's been cold enough to snow, there's none on the ground. Still, it's winter in Wisconsin, and Brad is barefoot. I watch as he watches the fence, like a dog on high alert, body tensed, ready to spring on whatever might be lying in wait out there. I didn't hear him leave, but I hear him come in, and I meet him in the hallway. For the first time, I notice how far away he looks. As if his body was here and his mind, his thoughts, everything else inside of him were still stuck somewhere a million miles away. His eyes are black and empty, and when I ask him what he was doing, he says, "Just checking." "For what?" I ask. "It's 3 a.m, baby." He looks past me with those eyes, and then he walks past me and back to bed. "Just checking," he says once more, his voice trailing down the hallway in his wake.
That's such a... It's a beautiful and it's also very ominous scene. That's when she first begins to realize that the man who came home to her is not the same as the man who left. And I love that line about the, he seems a million miles away from her, because, you know, we started talking about hidden stories. And I think the truth is that it's not just that the stories of what's happened in the war, the stories these men bring back, are not being told to the rest of us. It's that often they can't tell them to themselves either, I think. Am I saying that right?
I think so, definitely.
That's very true.
Especially for Vietnam vets.
Still, after all this time, for Vietnam vets?
Yes. Yeah. For me, that's one of the real tragedies of the war. There's many ways you can parse that and talk about how difficult and traumatic experience that is, any war is. But yeah, what happened with Vietnam was because, in effect, we lost the war, and we didn't win the peace. And the country was so divided and continues to be in some ways that the veteran was the person that was sort of left holding the bag. And, you know, we were part of the reason that we didn't win. We weren't the right kind of fighters, or we didn't do the right kind of fighting. We were hopped up on drugs, or we were crazy. And that has stuck with Vietnam vets. You know, Ronald Reagan tried to sort of reform that notion and call it a noble cause. But the reality was the vets came home one at a time into communities without support, without thanks, and without what they needed to be able to get their lives back together. And the tragedy of all, 18 veterans a day kill themselves in this country. That's the average. One active duty soldier a day. Those are comparable to combat rates. Those are lives we could and should save.
That's more people who have died in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do we know, I mean, that's a horrific figure. Are those mostly the younger vets who are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan?
It's a mix. Mm-hmm. there's, you know, right now the largest, we're losing Vietnam vets at a quicker rate now that we're in our 60s than we are World War II vets, because there are so many fewer of those, not as many Korean vets. With the active duty soldier suicides, that's of course that is our Iraq and Afghanistan vets.
Mm-hmm. Oh. We're talking today about writing and veteran stories, and I want to get around to talking about the writing projects you're both involved in. But in the meantime, today, as we head into the Memorial Day weekend and we talk about veterans and writing, you can join us. If you're a veteran or you know someone who is, how has writing or reading about the war helped you make the transition from the front lines to life back home? We welcome your calls at 800-642-1234, or you can email us, and the address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Dear old papa, sister, and brother, I dreamed about that girl who's been waiting far so long. I want to go home.
We're talking about veterans and writing this morning with novelist Aaron Salello and Doug Bradley. And a reminder, Doug Bradley will be the featured speaker at Wisconsin Public Radio's Veterans event in Milwaukee. That's at 7 p.m. on May 29th at the Milwaukee Historical Society. Details at wpr.org/Milwaukee. And Aaron and Doug will both be giving readings tonight at Arcadia Books in Spring Green. That's 7 o'clock tonight in Spring Green. If you're in the area, stop by. Both of you, I know, are involved in veterans writing projects. Tell me a little about what you're involved with, Erin.
Well, I teach creative writing and also composition at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. And so this past semester, I piloted a class, a writing class specifically for veterans and military personnel and their families. And so that's been a fantastic experience in giving them a place to connect with one another in the campus community.
And I mean, there's been a lot written and even studied about the therapeutic power of writing, I think. Have you found that to be the case?
Yeah, I mean, with that class, it's been a lot of, like I said, allowing them a place to form those connections and also sort of making the leap from military writing to academia, which is sometimes like a foreign language. But as far as the healing power of writing, I think I also work with the Veterans Writing Project out of D.C. as a writing mentor. And so I've been working with a veteran recently who's writing his memoir about a particularly horrible battle that he was in Iraq. He was deployed early, I think in 2004 or 2005, kind of at the height of things over there. And so it's been a fantastic experience working with him and seeing him kind of come to these conclusions and just confront his experiences.
Doug, what do you think writing about a wartime experience can do for someone that is different from, say, just talking about it?
I think what happens with writing is that you have an opportunity to sort of get a sense of, you create some context, and I think and you sort of can get outside yourself, whether it's just, it's all first person and it's a journal entry, but you begin to create a story, and there's a way that either you can narrate that story and distance yourself a bit if you need to do that to be able to understand it, or that you can embed your story, to that term we used before, that you can get into that and have some kind of personal catharsis. It doesn't happen for everybody. It doesn't always work. Writing is not necessarily the way for everyone.
Of course.
But it's, for what we've found in a couple of the projects I'm involved with, one is a group that's been meeting here regularly for years, and we put out a little magazine on our own. It's called the Deadly Writers Patrol.
That's a great name.
Isn't it? And we have now, our ranks are expanding, unfortunately. I guess it's better than contracting, but I mean, it's just that there are two other venues now. So we're starting to get more participation from Iraq and Afghanistan vets, which is marvelous, because everybody needs to be able to process this. And the other project my colleague Craig Werner and I have been working on is the music-based memories of the Vietnam experience, because as we mentioned before, some vets still have not been able to talk about the experience. They haven't found people that want to listen, but they will talk about a song. And then the song will become the throughway for them to process their experience. And we found that's been a very healing process. The writing, as I mentioned, through Deadly Writers Patrol, but also through the music.
That's a whole other. We have to have you back for an hour just to talk about that and play music. And
more than an hour. We'll dance.
That sounds good. We've got a caller on the line, Bill from Sun Prairie, who wants to join us. Hi, Bill.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Doug, this is Bill Baker. I'm a Vietnam veteran.
Welcome home, Bill.
Yeah, thank you. Welcome home to you, too. I was there 67 through 68, 20 months, through the Tet Offensive.
Ooh.
And I was on the, get this, I was on the perimeter the night the bombing started of Chu Lai Air, Marine Air Base.
Oh, man. You made it.
Yeah, I was right in line with the rockets coming in over my bunker.
Whew.
And they were, because right behind me were the two Phantom F-4s that sat on the hot pad ready to be put in the air.
Yeah.
First rocket that come in took those two F-4s out.
Oh, boy.
You know, so, and then, of course, later that night, they blew up the bomb dump.
Yep.
And I, you know, there's no Fourth of July celebration in the world that can even come close to comparing what I saw that night.
Jeez.
You know, so.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, I just wanted to say, this fall I'm going to do my sixth season of auditing classes, and I hope to audit your class this fall. And, you know.
Bill, can I just wanted to interrupt. Have you tried writing about any of your experiences?
I've done some writing, yes. Not, you know, just short bits here and there, but that's one of the things I want to do.
Yeah,
I want to get into it and you know, write about this. You know, the particularly the Vietnam veteran. I think you hit the nail on the head, Doug, when you talked about how we come back. Not even. I mean, I worked side by side with a guy for 15 years, both of us Vietnam veterans, and neither one of us knew it. Till, you know, we had worked together for that many years.
Bill, we hear that story way too often, you know, about neighbors and friends and family even. Well, I'm glad you made it. And, you know, for folks that don't know the history of the war, that 67 and 68, there couldn't have been a more difficult period. And what you talked about right when the Tet Offensive was launching, I hope not only will you come to the class, maybe music will be a way through, but I hope you keep writing about it. And check out the Deadly Writers Patrol magazine as well. We'd love to have your story.
Bill, thank you so much for calling. Aaron, I'm curious. There's been, of course, a fair amount of fiction published about the Vietnam War, not so much about Iraq or Afghanistan. Do you think it's just too soon, or are there other reasons for that?
I think it's probably just too soon. But, you know, in the last year, really, we've seen just an onslaught of, well, maybe onslaught is a little bit of a big word compared to what there was, I guess. But there's been a lot more fiction and published about Iraq and Afghanistan, from Kevin Powers' The Yellowbirds to now I'm blanking on the title of
Brian
the book.
Brian Casper, The Long Walk of... the halftime walk of Billy.
Billy.
Well, I sometimes wonder, though, on the other hand, whether the public or the reading public, there's a certain amount of, I mean, one of the things veterans cope with is the war weariness of the public, the unwillingness or lack of interest in the public on hearing those stories. You know, so people like Bill, you come home and you may go back to work with people, and you don't tell your story because you assume, why would anybody else be interested or be able to relate? You lock it inside yourself. And I wonder about that also.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that's very real, and it's feedback that I mentioned, the Iraq war veteran that I'm working with. He's approached a couple of agents, and they said, you know, oh, Iraq is done. You know, we're on to Afghanistan and other things now. And, you know, a couple of film agents have said that about my book. And, you know, maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it's the quality of the book. But, you know, they've said, you know, know, this is, the public's just tired of hearing about this stuff. And, you know, that's frustrating.
Which is such a horrific thing as a veteran. You know, you think these people put their lives on the line and they've come back permanently changed and, you know, and it's not the flavor of the day anymore.
Yeah.
We just don't want to hear anymore.
Yeah. And if you could, you know, just anyone out there can go on online and read some of these blogs by these spouses who are dealing with these issues on a day-to-day basis, and they're weary, and you know, it's only serving to isolate them more, I think, if we don't talk about it. And so I think it's really important that we keep talking about it, and these things keep being published, and movies are continue to be made.
When both of you work with veterans on writing, are there specific tips? Are there things you say to sort of help get people started, Doug?
I think it's start where you are and what you can do. Sometimes you can use prompts. You know, if you're in a sort of a classroom setting or a writing group, when I'm working with individual vets, what you can't do is expect there's this eureka moment and you've got 15 minutes. When I've gone to talk to guys about a song, for example, with the music book, you don't just jump in and out of the, you stay and you don't. You don't get distracted, and you wait for that moment to come. And part of it's just active listening. And then with writing, I think it's just a matter of is there a sound? Is there a smell? Sometimes if you talk to Vietnam vets about what the heat was like in that country or what some of the smells were like or the feel of the country, that can start something in a way that you can't say, you know, talk about when you almost died or when you killed somebody or when your best friend was killed. You know, you let that come if it'll come. But there's other ways. And really the sensor, that's why music's been such a great thing. But sometimes it's the smell and just the feel of what that was like.
Have you found the same thing, Erin?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of what Doug's talking about, too, is just using the same techniques, writing techniques that I would push any of my students to use. And, you know, a lot of the veterans that I've worked with in terms of writing, it's been just they're ready to tell their stories and they're ready. They have something they want to say. And so it's helping them mold and craft that in much the same way that you would anyone else. And I think just also just giving them a place to do that and a mental space and in addition to a physical space to be able to do that.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about writing and the potential benefits of writing about a wartime experience is that writing lets you both go back into the experience, and yet because there's the element of craft, it lets you pull yourself back so you can kind of mediate back and forth, go in just as far as you can, but then pull back to think of this as, no, it's not my memory. This is craft. I'm controlling it. I'm shaping it. Does that help, do you think?
It can. I mean, definitely it does, but it doesn't always happen. And what we talk about with vets, including some of us members of the Deadly Writers Patrol, is that just get to the story as well as you can. If this becomes a memoir, if you just need to put this down in the way it happened and how now 30, 40, 45 years afterwards you remember it, that's fine. For me, as we talked about with the excerpt you mentioned, somehow I needed that distance, and then I needed to craft it. You know, I had to say, well, this isn't exactly the way it happened, but if it's going to be a story and these are characters now, that's the arc of a good story, and that's how those characters are going to change. And it doesn't work for everybody, but that's one of the best ways to have that happen.
Well, and I'm thinking for you as a fiction writer, especially drawing on your own experiences, you know, maybe you couldn't have done this until it was this many years afterwards, but to take something horrible and turn it into art, wow. I mean, that's a fairly redemptive thing to do, it seems.
I think it's the most redemptive thing to do.
Is there an excerpt you could read for us from
Certainly.
Your book?
Certainly, yeah, I'd be glad
maybe
to.
Set it up, tell us about
yes,
the story.
Yes, the interesting thing about this collection was that because I tried often for many years to write a novel, and it just wasn't coming. And of course, as you indicated before, there have been a number of fantastic novels written about the Vietnam War. I will say, as you and Erin were discussing, it took a while. Mm-hmm. It was not right away. And before things began to come out, and we got some great writers like Tim O'Brien and
the
Carl
things they carried.
Oh yeah, and Carl Marlantis's book, which just came out a few years ago, is absolutely terrific. The excerpt I'm going to read, because I have these, what I have is 16, what you would call short stories, and what I call 16 interlinears. They're sort of little snapshots that go, that attend the other story and are like a different way into the story you just read. It might pull out a minor character or just a line that was mentioned. So this is one of the stories in there, and I think as every Vietnam vet would probably tell you, the way they've survived that experience was through the love of a woman who helped them get back home. So I have a story in here. Since this was mainly a male experience, now it's changed with this war. Of course, we have women in combat as well. But it's called The Girls They Left Behind. I'll just read a little bit from the end of that piece. The girls they left behind joined the same therapy group, but they didn't call it that. Their rap group met every Wednesday night for 2 hours inside a tiny room with dirty beige walls, cast-off furniture, and one lone light bulb. They bared their souls and cried and swore and hugged and hollered. The rap group girls, as they called themselves, smoked cigarettes and drank Mountain Dew. They broke the ice with beanbag tosses and swapped stories about their men. They laughed when they wanted to cry and cried when they wanted to laugh. Linda Donovan ended up needing the group more than the group needed her. Her brother Billy died in a high-speed car accident, and his death left a hole in her heart. The other women gave her the time and the space to bandage that wound. Martha Poole and Sally McBride almost came to blows, but they dropped their guards and forged a bond. They both liked Getz beer and rummage sales. Carla Miller helped Pilar Cologne shop at her Safeway on double coupon days. Pilar made quesadillas for Carla and the rest of the group. The girls they left behind begged the men who came home to talk to them about how they were feeling, to hold them tight in bed at night, to join them in their Wednesday rap group. The men who came home didn't know what to say. They were still fighting the war. The girls they left behind grew strong and at ease. They sang Aretha Franklin songs and harmonized on Neither One of Us by Gladys Knight and the Pips. They cooked and they cleaned and they worked and they believed. They held their men's hands and they prayed to their God. The only people they told about their own pain were one another, and they only did that on Wednesday nights. The girls they left behind were no longer girls. They were women. They were pillars of strength and rivers of wisdom. They were the North Star and the true compass. And slowly, eventually, they brought their men back home to stay.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. Thank you. Reminds us that, in a certain way, the families, the spouses of soldiers who served have also served.
That's right. Family goes to war.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, what you just described is it's a tribute to the loyalty of the women and the girls who stayed with their men. Aaron, your novel is the story of just how difficult that is. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because those are stories we don't hear that much.
Sure. And that's actually one of the things that people like to bring up the most when I've gone to speak to book groups and so forth with this novel is the choice that the narrator Elise makes to stay or leave her husband. And no one understands the choice. And, it just goes to show you that it's a very complicated thing. An unbelievable loyalty, like you said, that recognizing that someone who has gone off to war and is now encountering the difficulties that they are, that's not their choice either. And, they're all kind of caught up in the circumstance. And one of the best descriptions that I've heard about this is by a woman named Annie Mosley, who writes a blog called Our Before and After. And she writes extensively about how she will keep loving her husband even though he can't love her back. And she knows that he can't love her back, not because he doesn't want to, but because this is like the same for her. She views it as the same as him having cancer or, some other sort of illness that's beyond his control. And so she sticks by him. And that's a heart-wrenching account of how these choices are playing out every day for some of these families.
And on the other hand, you've got another character in your novel who leaves her husband. He's, mm-hmm. He's disabled and he's in a care facility and she recognizes that she cannot do this anymore. And he understands. That's mm-hmm. one of the most beautiful exchanges in your book that, mm-hmm. that he doesn't blame her for leaving.
Mm-hmm. I really wanted to make sure and represent all different sides of this equation in the book. And so through these three characters, both, as you mentioned, Sandra, the woman who leaves her husband, Elise, my narrator, who ends up, I don't want to give away an ending or anything, but she ends up making a choice based on loyalty and love, and then her friend Darcy, who I mentioned at the beginning, whose husband dies and in combat, and all of the different situations and difficulties and issues that those three characters face separately. I really wanted to represent the range of experiences.
I really liked it that you did not oversimplify women's experience or imply that there's only one best way to be. Yeah. We've got another caller on the line. Michael from Milwaukee has called. Hi, Michael. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. One of the things that I did that I think helped me cope is I created and built a website, which I still maintain, and that was helpful. Also, the fact that a lot of people contribute to the website and contribute short stories or stories, if you want to call them that, or poetry and stuff like that, and share pictures and stuff like that. And I think one of the things that I have on my website is something that comes up that says our story has to be told and cannot be forgotten. And it's terribly important to keep your message out there. I think myself being a Vietnam veteran, looking back, now I realize how messed up I was at the time and how many years it really took me to probably get my head somewhat straight. And back then you didn't realize that another thing we had to cope with was the fact that Vietnam veterans at the time were pretty much despised by a good percentage, if not the majority of the country. You pretty much didn't want to even say you were from Vietnam, and if you did even mention it, people right away said, you guys are nuts, or you guys are crazy, or you guys all have issues, or whatever. So you had to kind of almost hide the fact that you were a veteran for many years. But yeah. Anyways, that helped. My website is out there. It's h-co. If somebody Googles that, you can find it, 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. There's some good stories on there and some nice pictures. I was a tank driver for a year in Vietnam. During the Tet Offensive, we were up about 80 kilometers north of the Saigon area when Tet Offensive started, up at a rubber plantation, Lac Ninh rubber plantation, right off the Cambodian border, and our mission was to do a forced road march right down to the Saigon area. We went through, I think it was Lai K, was under area of Lai K base was under attack. We drove right through it because we could not stop. Our mission was to keep going. So there was a lot of things that I saw along with everybody else.
Yeah.
But that is so far behind, but we still carry those things with us today.
Absolutely, Michael. Right. Welcome home. And websites have been wonderful. That's one of the great things about the Internet is a number of units and divisions, even my office, we're able to connect with one another. There's been reunions, so and sometimes a picture can tell 1,000 words. So I'm glad for your website, and I'm glad you made it home.
The other thing about the more recent wars, the Iraq-Afghanistan wars, people have called these the first blogging wars. So many soldiers, even during, while they were in service, were keeping blogs. And some of those have gone on. There's been poetry that's come out of the war, fiction that nonfiction published from some of those blogs. So I have to think that's a really good thing. Just to wrap up thinking about the, Mike touched on it, the people who, when you come home, you feel like other people don't want to hear about it and actually may not be compassionate, may have real objections to the war. I tend to think that that may be true, but that there are so many of us who, didn't serve, don't have military in the family, feel so much compassion and also feel helpless and uncertain of what even to say to a veteran you may know. Do you have thoughts for those of us who may not know what to say? Sometimes thank you for your service seems so flat.
Mm-hmm. I like Doug's bit that he says is welcome home. I think that's great. But I think even just acknowledging, what these vets and their families have gone through is an important thing. Asking about it. I was talking to a book group the other day, and they said, this woman said, my neighbor's husband was deployed for a year, and I just kind of treated it as a long business trip that he was on. I didn't, you know, for her, it was like the war was happening on CNN, and there wasn't this bridge between between real life and what was going on TV. So I think she felt guilty about not acknowledging that. So I think that might be important for families, but Doug might have some other thoughts.
Well, I think we need just to be there for people. You're right. That statement's become hollow. We've talked about supporting the soldier in this war and not the war necessarily. We've tried to make a separation. Can't do it.
Thank you both so much for being here today. Erin Salello teaches writing at the UW-Whitewater, and she's the author of a new novel, Learning to Stay. Doug Bradley, Vietnam veteran, writer, and educator, author of Deros, Vietnam, Dispatches from the Air-Conditioned Jungle. A reminder, Doug will be the featured speaker at WPR's Veterans Event in Milwaukee at 7 o'clock on May 29th at the Milwaukee Historical Society. Details at wpr.org/Milwaukee. And Erin and Doug will be reading at Arcadia Books in Spring Green tonight at 7 p.m. I'm Ann Strange Champs, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Imagine a world in which wars are fought not by the young, but by senior citizens. That's the starting premise of John Scalzi's science fiction universe, The Old Man's War. It's one of the most widely read, most award-winning sci-fi series being published today, and there's a brand new volume just out called The Human Division. John, I want to start at the beginning, The Old Man's War, the first book in the series, sure. The one that made you famous. How did you dream up this concept of a world in which wars are fought by the old?
Well, the first thing I did was I kind of cheated, which is that I was reading Starship Troopers by Robert Heinlein. I was like, I want to write something like that. And so I just borrowed liberally from him to begin with. But one of the things that you always want to do is, regardless if you're doing even a classic trope like military science fiction, you want to bring a new angle to it. And for me, we've always had the experience of the young man leaves the farm, goes off to seek his adventure and, you know, find his fortune. But we've never had something specifically where somebody who is at the ends of his days gets the same opportunity. And why shouldn't they have the same opportunity? Because in some ways, the older folks would be better warriors than the younger folks, that they would have better judgment. They'd have a little bit more wisdom. They'd be less spooked. They would be less inclined to make rash decisions in the heat of the moment because they've already had a life, an entire lifetime worth of experience. And also, quite frankly, they would no longer be a danger to the demographics of their country. And World War I came around. And in England, for example, you know, there was an entire generation that was lost. The lost generation. And how much easier and simpler, if you have the technology, than to take people who are at the back end of that demographic bulge and just snip them off and take them off somewhere else. And so that – it made perfect logical sense to me in a science fictional context that you would do it. And I looked around and there were some, you know, short stories that had hinted at it, but there was nothing that was a novel-length exploration of it. And so here we go. That seems to make sense to me.
So when these guys join up, it's usually when they're around 70.
75,
and,
yeah.
Right. And they assume that once they've joined up, they're going to get some kind of super hormonal cocktail or something.
Right.
And all their cells will be rejuvenated. And it turns out to be a little more radical than that.
Yeah. There's a consciousness transfer and they're put into brand new bodies that are so genetically engineered that they're not exactly human anymore. And
what do they look like?
Well, they're green for one thing because there's chlorophyll in them in order to give them a little extra energy boost. And they all look between the ages of like 20 and 25, and every single one of them is absolutely gorgeous. And so they're very excited about it. And of course, you use the bodies the way that you would use the bodies when you were 21 through 25. But there is a flip side. There is a cost, and the cost simply is that they are going to war, and within 2 years, like 75% of them are going to be dead because that's the reality of the universe that they live in, that it is unceasing battle and that they will have to sacrifice those beautiful new bodies on the altar of keeping humanity alive. Or at least that's what they're told.
Now, along the way, you invented some fascinating new technologies and new kinds of science. There are What are they called? The Brain Pal?
Brain Pal. The Brain Pal is a computer and it rests in your head and it interfaces with your brain so completely that after the first week of going, this is weird, I have a computer in my head, you stop thinking about it. And there are a lot of people that's like, I could never get used to the idea of a computer in my head. I'm like, really? How often do you think about your phone? Right? Your phone now is, you know, has more computing power than every single Apollo program, you know, spacecraft put together. It is, you know, you're always checking your email, you're always texting, you're always taking pictures. You never think about it in terms of the genuine, you know, miracle it is and how weird it is even, you know, 10, 15 years ago to think about all you can do with your phone. You look at a Star Trek communicator from Star Trek, the original series, and you're like, really, Kirk? All you've got is voice? You couldn't text Scotty? So there, you know, as far as it goes, people really get acclimated to technology really quickly.
Well, so people like playing around with this idea, you know, the singularity or what happens when we all have chips in our head. But the thing your Brain Pal does is it gives everybody this kind of hive mind, which maybe I'm just not the Facebook generation, but honestly, that just seems like Facebook on steroids.
Right. Well,
sounds nightmarish.
There are lots of things that if you think through, you know, some of the technology that I and other science fiction writers develop, you're just kind of like, wait a minute, do I really want this? People, you know, when I go on tour and they say, would you want a Brain Pal? And I'm like, no. And they're like, what? And you invented the Brain Pal. Why wouldn't you want one? I was like, here's what would happen. The first day, you get it, you plug it in, and you're like, this is awesome. And you do whatever it is you do with your Brain Pal, and you're happy. The second night, you wake up in the middle of the night, and you have Russian Viagra spam in your head, and it never, ever, ever, ever goes away. And it's in your brain. It's not like you can just pop it out. I mean, I watch Google Glass. On one sense, you know, mm-hmm. On one sense, I want the Google Glass because it just looks really cool. And when I was on tour in Mountain View, there were a couple of people there with a Google Glass apparatus, and I was like,
Did they let you try it on?
No, I was too polite to ask, but I was like, no, there are a lot of Google people here. Maybe I could just mug one. But on the other hand, there will be very quickly, very soon, a rash of people walking into pillars, walking out into traffic because they're going to spend all their time focusing on the Google Glass. People do that already with their phones.
Is it challenging to be a science fiction writer today when technology moves ahead so fast?
Here's my feeling about it. Science fiction's role is not to be accurate. Science fiction's role is to model possible futures. And that's one of the things that we do really well. We take our current desires, we take our current enthusiasm, we take our current fears, and we build them out as scenarios so that we as a society can sort of have practice runs at them. A perfect example, I honestly believe that one of the reasons that we avoided nuclear war is because science fiction literature, science fiction film, science fiction television spent so much time imagining everything from on the beach to, you know, Mad Max, where there was this post-apocalyptic world, the Terminator, that in some ways we got to experience the very deep negatives of having that thing happen.
Well, that makes me feel better about all of the dystopian fiction and the dystopian, you know, movies and TV that's come out, you know, rather than as a sign of just how depressed we are. Maybe, in fact, we're galvanizing ourselves to avoid that future.
Exactly, because if you can see all these things that are happening, you can see, the, you know, not so much the zombies, but the viruses or, you know, the depletion of the ozone or whatever it is that you're worried about, and you can see the consequences of it in film. It's all fictional, to be clear, but we get used to the idea of, maybe that wouldn't be, you know, the thing. And everyone wants to believe, oh, you know, in the Mad Max world, I would be one of those guys, you know, who's gonna survive. But you know what? Most of us are kind of pudgy and soft. And, you know, when it comes right down to it, it's best to actually try to preserve the world what we have and make it work than to, you know, go on in this sort of hard scrabble world. So, yeah, no, the dystopic stuff is not that science fiction is pessimistic. It is science fiction saying, OK, this is what you're concerned about. Let's take it to its logical extreme. And would that be something you would be happy with? No, maybe you ought to think about that.
So what happens in this new latest installment of the Old Man's War series? This one is The Human Division.
The Human Division. Well, in this one, in the last four books, we discover or the Earth discovers that the Colonial Union, which is the human polity out in space, has basically been farming them for colonists and soldiers and sort of kind of keeping them down so that the whole farming for colonists and soldiers can continue. And they're not very happy about it because, well, of course, why would you be? And so they're trying to reach a new equilibrium between the Colonial Union and Earth. But this is the season where you meet all the characters, you get the lay of the land, and you begin to learn that there is a real human crisis. We are very close to extinction if we don't play our cards right. And the deck, it's stacked, and it's stacked against us.